Why do people go bald?
Why are baboons' bums red?
What's a light year?
Why do leaves go brown in the autumn?
Why do monkeys like bananas?
Why do some things glow in the
dark? Why do animals not understand humans?
Why do my receipts fade after a year?
Don't know the answer? Ask the Naked Scientists.
Hello and welcome to this week's Ask the Naked Scientists with me, Sue Marchant, and Dave Ansell. So what is new in the world of science for you?
Well, I saw a nice little story this week about self-healing paint. You know, if you've got a car or a phone or something and you just general wear and tear tends to get little scratches in it all the time.
Yeah.
And some scientists in southern Mississippi have come up with a way of paint which just heals itself.
Really?
Yeah, what they've done is they've taken polyurethane, which is the same kind of plastic as you often get in floor varnishes or that kind of expanding foam.
Mm.
And they've added some stuff called chitosan into it, which you get from shells of lobsters and crabs. And altered that slightly chemically, adding some chemical rings onto it, oxetane rings onto it. Then if you scratch it, you break some of these rings. And then you get this sort of broken ring, which is quite chemically reactive. And if you leave it out in the sun, it gets some energy from the ultraviolet light in the sun. That gives it a load of energy. And the ones at the bottom of the crack then bond onto the ones on the other side, something onto the other side of the crack, and glues it up. And then slowly, then that brings the crack a bit closer. And the next ones up with a bit more ultraviolet light will bond up and sort of drag itself back together and close it up, like doing up a zip. And so after a while, if you leave it in the sun, all the little, there's only little scratches at the moment, they kind of pull themselves together, zip themselves up.
Yeah.
And it's almost as good as new.
Dr. Dave, ready for our first question tonight. Andrew in Cambridge, he says, how does a computer memory stick work?
Yeah, computer memory sticks are incredible things. The amount of information you can get on a tiny little thing you plug into your computer and you can store gigabytes of information onto it. Basically, they've got a little computer chip inside them, and inside that chip you've got what's called flash memory. And inside that you've basically got a wire which the memory can use to test, which basically tests, and if electricity can get through that wire, then that gives it some information. If it can't get through so well, then that's another piece of information. And above that wire you've got a little piece of metal which is sort of insulated from everything else. And then if you want to store information on it, you either put some electrons into that wire and make it charged, in which case it makes it harder for electricity to flow through the original test wire, or you take them out when it gets easier. So if you've got some electrons in there, you can try and put a current through it and find out whether they're there or not. And so you've got a way of storing information. You then multiply that by several billion times. I think modern flash memory chips, you're talking tens of billions of times, these little tiny cells. And then you can store hundreds and hundreds of either ones or zeros, and then you can use a whole lot of ones and zeros to turn into numbers or pictures or sound or videos, whatever you like.
Fantastic.
It's basically just electrons stopping other electrons flowing or not.
I hope that's answered your question then, Andrew. Our next question comes from a caller on the line. We've got Ken. Good evening, Ken.
Hello there.
What's your question for Dave?
It's regarding the latest position on a car running on air. The French are working on a prototype car that's working on compressed air, and all it does is you use a small generator, fill up the car tank with compressed air, unplug the generator, and the latest on the trials is that she's now reaching 100 miles without recharging.
That's impressive, certainly, yeah. I mean, it's an approach. It's kind of a slightly scary approach because if you're storing energy as compressed air, it's very easily released energy because if you get a crack in those tanks, it's a wonderful idea, and if they can make it work safely, that's
great.
Well,
it's worth up to 100 miles.
I don't know whether it will cut. I mean, all these things to do with economics. I mean, it could quite easily. I haven't heard any more than you have, I'm afraid. If getting 100 miles isn't bad, battery cars, they're in sort of similar region. My feeling is that probably electric cars are probably going to end up coming in a bigger way, definitely for long journeys.
Oh, right.
I know, having worked in labs, you get these really big sort of 6 foot high compressed air cylinders.
Mm.
And everyone's petrified of them because if they fall over and the end breaks off them, they turn into rockets and go through walls I mean, they'll go through sort of brick walls, stone walls, and keep on going for several hundred feet. They turn into rockets. And, I mean, anything which is storing energy is dangerous. Petrol's got a lot of energy in it, so it's dangerous. But it's to do with how easily that energy is released.
So they're exhaust, apparently.
As a gas, you're fine. It's just in a crack. I mean, there's no reason why it shouldn't work. And if they can make it work, that's wonderful.
Can I ask you one more question regarding cars? You know a car roof,
yes,
right? Can't they build a false roof and fill it in between with helium, and that will take off some of the weight of the car and gain more petrol consumption that way?
It would gain you some weight. The problem is the most weight you can gain with helium. Basically, helium works because it's lighter than air, so it floats on air. And the most weight you can gain, air is basically the weight of air. And air weighs about a gram per cubic per litre. So for every litre of helium you have in the top of your car, you will gain about a gram.
Ah, right.
And the effort would be, you'd be much better putting that effort into making some bits of metal slightly thinner somewhere else in the car.
You're very kind. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you. Now, our next question is from Mike in Colchester, who says, I see Sue as a champagne drinker and wanted to know, if you shake a bottle and open it, it explodes. However, if you shake it, then leave it for 24 hours and extract the cork carefully, it doesn't. Where does the gas go?
The simple answer is into the champagne. Basically, the reason why champagne doesn't explode if you open it normally and very carefully is that although the champagne is under pressure and there's far more carbon, when it's under pressure, lots of carbon dioxide dissolves in the champagne. Then when you release that pressure, not as much carbon dioxide should be able to dissolve in the champagne, so it wants to get out somewhere, somehow. What it wants to do is turn into a gas, form bubbles, and those bubbles grow, and then that's how it escapes champagne. However, the problem is there's an effect called surface tension in water, and champagne is mostly water, which means that water molecules are attracted to other water molecules. And so if you form a very, very small bubble, then just starting, if you've just got no bubbles in there, if you've got a very, very tiny bubble, then that surface tension is strong enough to crush that bubble again, and that carbon dioxide then dissolves back into the gas. So if you've got no bubbles in it at all, it will sit there, and the carbon dioxide will only just escape at the surface very slowly over a long time. If you shake it up, there's a little bit of air in the top of the bottle, and you get little bubbles inside the champagne to start with, well, not sort of bigger bubbles. And it's much harder for the surface tension to crush a big bubble. So if you then let the pressure off by taking off the lid, you've got thousands of bubbles in there already, and they can grow really quickly. So all those bubbles grow, it turns into a great big huge pile of foam and sprays over everybody. So if you, basically, when you leave it overnight, then all of the bubbles slowly rise to the surface or get redissolved inside the champagne. So there's none there to start with. So the bubbles can't form very quickly. The carbon dioxide can't escape. It can't form a foam and it can't make a mess.
Clever stuff. An email from Paul in Ipswich. Hello, Paul. He asks, is man the only mammal that has racial features, i.e. there are mongoloid, negroid, australoid, australoid cats, dogs, apes, etc.? And if not, why is this the case? Dave?
Well, I think basically what you mean by racial features is different groups inside a species who look slightly different for some genetic reason. And dogs are probably the best example of a species with lots of different sort of subspecies, which look very different, because you get Great Danes, basically it's breeds. A Great Dane looks incredibly different from a little Pekingese, which is different from a Springer Spaniel. And all the breeds of dogs are equivalent, but far more extreme than different races of humans. The difference between a Great Dane and a Pekingese is immensely more than any type of humans. In fact, humans are probably one of the least varied genetically species out there.
I don't know.
In fact, the genetic diversity in humans is less than mountain gorillas, although there's only a few hundred mountain gorillas. They think that our species went down to very, very few individuals, a few tens of thousands of years ago, and then we've all descended from very few number of individuals. So there's very little genetic diversity there to start with.
Sure,
we haven't had time to build it up through mutations.
Right. Mark the Storeman says he was reading the paper and he saw that there is an electric car to be put onto the market that will cover over 260 miles on one overnight charge, costing around £1. He appreciates that petrol is an expensive fuel, but how can an electric car be made to run so cheaply, from Mark the Storeman?
Okay, I'm surprised that it's quite that cheap. There's a variety of things going on. One of them is that petrol is most of the money you pay to petrol is actually tax. So you're paying, I think, sort of at least two-thirds, if not more, of the petrol you buy. Definitely now, again, it was less when petrol prices went up so much, is tax. So you might be paying 90 pence to buy your litre of fuel, but actually that litre of fuel probably only costs 30 pence to start with, if not less. Other things are that a car is relatively an inefficient way of converting fuel into mechanical energy. An electric motor, a power station is much more efficient at converting into electricity, and an electric motor is very efficient at converting electricity into movement. So you gain a bit there. I think probably the biggest effect, though, is that most electric cars are basically very light and very aerodynamic, so they don't use very much power to start with. And if you drive them efficiently, then they just don't use very much power because you're not pushing a big car through the air, you're not lifting it up and down hills. So I think between all of those, you'll certainly end up a lot cheaper than a conventional car. Whether it's a pound for 260 miles, I don't know. That sounds a bit extreme, but
I'm sure
they've managed it somehow.
Yeah, be good, though. And more questions, Dave. This time from Tony in Chelmsford, who says, somebody told me that hyperspace travel would be possible as they're looking into folding space. Is this true, or is someone having a laugh?
Yes. There's lots of... if you want to travel across the galaxy, it would be really nice to be able to move faster than the speed of light, because although in our world, light's ridiculously fast. It goes at 300,000 kilometres every second. When you start looking at distances between stars, the closest star other than the Sun is about four... It takes light about 4 years to get to it. If you want to go much further, you're talking about hundreds of years at the speed of light to be able to get anywhere. And that would be a pain. So lots of people have been trying to come up with, particularly science fiction writers, ways of being able to get spaceships between stars much more quickly. One of the ones which people have talked about is hyperspace, which I think the idea is that you sort of bend space so that although it appears you're moving relatively slowly in space, but actually space has got shorter, so you've sort of travelled, according to everyone else's space, much further, much quicker, which would be nice. I think various sort of theoretical physicists do look into this sort of thing occasionally, comparing it with the laws of Einstein's laws of gravity. And I think some of them have come up with ways it may possibly be conceivably possible, but I think normally it involves forms of matter which we haven't discovered, so things with negative mass or negative energy or something very exotic, which we certainly have no evidence for. So no one's looking into it in a practical way, only in sort of exciting sort of theoretical flights of fancy, really.
Nothing wrong with a few flights of fancy from time to time. Bob in Dunstable, he says, if you stood, as one does, on the moon with a compass, would there be any readings?
With the compass you use on the Earth, probably not. The magnetic field on the moon isn't a simple magnet like the Earth is. The Earth's magnet has got a south pole in the Earth's north pole and a north pole in the Earth's south pole, which sounds slightly odd, because actually what we mean by north pole is north-seeking pole. So that means that any magnets you've got are hanging around will... So the north pole is attracted to the Earth's magnetic south pole, which is at the Earth's north pole, so you can find which way is north. The moon doesn't have a simple magnetic field like that. It's more complicated. The Earth's magnetic field, we think, is made due to some complicated process in the Earth's core involving molten metal moving around and flowing while it's spinning. And this produces the simple magnetic field of the Earth. The moon has just got a load of rocks which happen to still be magnetised, possibly because the moon originally had its own source of magnetic field when it was still molten, and now it's all solidified. Or possibly because there are magnetic fields around when the Earth, due to big impacts or something, plasmas in the above the moon. And those have got frozen in the moon's surface. The magnetic field is about a hundredth of the strength as on the Earth. So if you had a super sensitive compass, you would pick up something. It wouldn't necessarily tell you where north was, but there would be a magnetic field there.
Fantastic. Now then, we've got Mark on the line. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Sue.
Hi, you're through to Dr. Dave.
Hello, Dr. Dave.
Hello.
I was wondering, when I was staying at a military base over Salisbury Plain, there was they were just forming the 24th Air Mobile Brigade, and it was activity going on all the while, you know, fighters, everything. Anyway, you could actually find out the date. It was 1988, and it was in September, and there was supposed to be a meteor shower that night. It was on Patrick Moore's programme, and me and another guy, we went and thought we'd have a look. You know, it was supposed to be sort of pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
And anyway, we were watching up, and as you know, stars go up and down, and they can sort of indicate north and west for, you know, your direction. But we just, if you look at them, they do tend to sort of move. And we saw these two stars sort of start moving along the sky. Just that's all I could say it was, two white, high white lights. And we'd seen all sorts of jets and fire.
Yeah.
But anyway, cut a long story short, whether, you know, I mean, I know what I saw, and these things accelerated at a speed. They played catch up and chase and came to a complete stop and then just... I was wondering if there was some extraterrestrials, could they use the way these pulsars and stars, could they use them the way they spin all at different frequencies? Could they use them the way that in the World War II we used, the bombers used oboe? Could they use them as sound buoys or markers to navigate?
So, it depends. I mean, using stars, I mean, conceivably you could use, pulsars are very large stars which get brighter and darker.
Yeah.
As I think it says, material is falling in onto them, and then it heats up and it gets very bright, and then it calms down again.
Yeah.
And so they sort of pulse at a very regular frequency.
Yeah.
If you're trying to navigate between around, if you had several pulsars in a galaxy and they were very, very predictable, I mean, you could use them as a way of navigating around the galaxy, conceivably. I think you'd probably be better off navigating by looking at where all the local stars are. If you had a map of where all the stars are, you'd be much more accurate.
This was just a crazy thought I had. Whether they could put an energy field out and magnetise ions, you know, and use that as a pulse sort of system. I'm not on the UFO, you know. I just know what I saw that night, but.
Yeah,
I'm open-minded about it all. You know,
There's no fundamental reason why there shouldn't be aliens coming round and looking at us.
No, I
personally haven't. I mean, the new thing is that it's quite easy to. There are all sorts of strange things which can produce. The other thing is at night. I'm not saying that it is this, but there's all sorts of things which could be. One of them is that it's very hard to judge distances.
Mm.
You could conceivably be something much closer to you, which moving about. I mean, if you had two glowing flies or moving about, and you'd lost your depth sense.
These were definitely really up high in the stratosphere.
Yeah.
So whatever they were, you know, as I say, we at first thought perhaps, you know, it just might be.
There's certainly things we don't understand.
It definitely wasn't the shower. You know, we didn't see anything like that. Anyway.
How fantastic!
Thanks for putting me in question. Anyway,
you're
bye
welcome.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Good night.
Bye bye. That's it for this week. Our doctors will be back with me next week for more Ask the Naked Scientist. But don't forget, you can also catch them on the Naked Scientist podcast, which you can find on the Naked Scientist website, www.nakedscientist.com.
The Naked Scientists are sponsored by the Wellcome Trust, the EPSRC, and UK FAST. For more information, look us up online at nakedscientists.com.